Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering a controversial non-resident user fee that is being discussed by Kingston City Council.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Coming just after difficult budget deliberations last month, Council considered a motion brought forward by Councillor Paul Shaves to look into implementing non-Kingston resident user fees for city facilities and services. The motion cites budget constraints and significant growth pressures, and argues for the importance of residents having equitable and prioritized access to city-owned facilities and services supported by their property taxes. Options suggested in the motion included differential pricing structures for non-residents, priority registration windows for Kingston residents for recreational programs, facility bookings, and other high-demand services, and resident-only access periods or capacity allocations for specific city-owned facilities. Loyalist was the only neighboring municipality explicitly identified in discussion as charging non-resident user fees. Councillor Connie Glenn was the first to bring up concerns with the idea.
You know, I understand the fiscal concerns that we are facing. I mean, we just went through a really difficult budget challenge. But I also am concerned about, to some degree, the neighborliness, if you will put it that way. I'm looking at what's happening in the broader context out here. We've just gone through a tariff scare, and hopefully it stays a scare. But it almost seems a little bit like this, that we're talking about our neighbors next door. And my concern with this motion has to do with that we maintain good relationships because we don't know when we're going to have to rely on our neighbors for support on something. So I'm okay with having a look at things, but I just want to make sure that we don't overstep in how we approach this and that we give consideration to the mutual support that we need to have in our region. So I'm going to leave it at that. I just find myself discomforted by the fact that we're bringing this kind of emotion.
Councillor Ryan Bohm brought up similar worries, also referencing the recent threats of tariffs from the United States.
My one concern here is just in light of sort of what's going on with the states right now is, you know, are we going to start a resident, non-resident user fee war with all our neighbors, and all of a sudden everybody's trying to outdo each other, and it just becomes this, you know, leapfrog effect where everybody's constantly raising their fees for non-residents.
Councillor Jeff McLaren also took issue with the idea, citing larger value-based concerns.
I'm very, very much against the very principle that this represents. We are setting up discriminatory walls, and it seems that other municipalities have also done that already, and we are going to just encourage this. It seems to be getting more, and where does it stop? Are we going to block everybody at some point because they're not paying taxes here? That doesn't seem to be part of the spirit of not discriminate against place of origin. We do have that as one of the principles that we live on in this country. And let's consider what we're doing here. We're actually going to create two tiers of citizenship or residency based on where you live. That doesn't seem right. There's something very wrong about that. Public amenities should be public, and equally so. There are lots of parks in Kingston that I don't visit, but I still pay taxes to fund that. Do we want to have the idea that, hey, if we don't use a particular amenity, I don't want to pay for it? we are being, this seems to me that we're being mean and petty and discriminatory.
Counselor Jimmy Hassan brought up his personal experience accessing local facilities, also arguing that Kingston should prioritize its taxpayers.
I remember that when me and my wife was waking up 4 o'clock, get into the line at the YMCA for the swimming lessons. And we are a taxpayer from 2005 since I bought my first house. And we are still paying taxes. And I see the still same situation from the Kingston resident. The long lines and, you know, they have to wake up early. And then still, it's not that we are opposing on them and forcing them to do that. But it's a lack of availability because the other people, other non-resident also in standing up in the line probably in front of them. And about the tariff, you know, we are not trading anything with them. So we are just offering them facilities here. When you use Frontenac transportation, you pay for them. We use their facility for ambulance, we pay for it. Or they pay to us too. It's no such a tariff thing. It's not terrible things asking a fair share to maintain the cost of it. They are welcome to use anytime. They can get into the line with our resident, but they have to pay a little bit more because our taxpayer paying the taxes to use the services from the city, and they deserve better and first.
After hearing from councillors, Mayor Brian Patterson made a final statement and requested that council wait for him to discuss the issue with other mayors.
I think this is about fairness. And you can be neighborly and talk about fairness, right? So the last couple of years, the mayors of all of our neighboring municipalities have been meeting. And it's been good discussions. And you know what we talk about? We talk about, are there ways that we may need to work together so that not every municipality is investing in the same thing? That maybe there are ways that we can partner and we can create, for example, recreational facilities that maybe can be shared. This, in my view, is just part of that discussion. We're just getting some information about potential possibilities about, okay, if we want to finance new pools or new arenas in the future that are very expensive or other facilities, that we can have those discussions to say, okay, well, there are different ways that, you know, if Kingston was to take the lead on it, the ways that we could look at different fee structures or we could look at different partnerships, as we've done so with Loyalist. And maybe there are other municipalities that may want to do the same thing with us, right? There's really nothing unneighborly about this. I think right now it's about getting information. I think what would be key is if council would indulge me, is if the information comes back and we think we want to discuss it further, then I would ask that you allow me to speak to the other mayors first so that we can have those discussions. So it's not something that we're just imposing unilaterally, but we're having those very open discussions about we're trying to figure out how to finance those pieces. These are fair and reasonable discussions that happen all the time between municipalities. So I think that we can all agree that the spirit around this table is not in any way antagonistic. It's just about figuring out how we can do more.
In the end, most councillors were open to exploring the idea, with only councillors Glenn and McLaren opposed. City staff will report back to council with research and recommendations for implementing non-Kingston resident fees in time to be considered as part of the 2026 municipal budget process. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Napanee Beaver, Sarah Williams, about a special Black History Month event being held at the Museum of Lenox and Addington.
Thank you, Jesse. The Museum of Lenox and Addington is honoring Black History Month with a celebration on Tuesday, February 18th, featuring a talk with Dr. Kenita Lila, Associate Curator, Arts of Africa from the Agnes Etherington Arts Center. The event will highlight Black history and culture while honoring the ancestors and leaders in Black communities, their accomplishments, and their continued fight for liberation. In her talk, Tracing a Black Presence in Kingston and Beyond, Lila will discuss how archives have filled historical blanks in her own research and how public arts programs are engaging the public to learn about Black history. This talk is inspired by a portrait of Tobias from 1864, currently housed in the archives of Lenox and Addington. Through her work, Leela cares for the Justin and Elizabeth Lang collection of African art and works with archives as well as contemporary art practice with the diaspora to engage the African collection in the present. She is interested in hidden histories, the life and afterlife of objects and collections, as well as the representation of racialized minorities and alternative practices of collections care. She has published in both peer-reviewed and popular publications, has contributed book chapters to anthologies, and hosts the podcast With Open Mouths. No registration is required for this event. The doors will open at 6:30, with the presentation to begin at 7 p.m. The cost is $5 per person, and the presentation is recommended for people ages 13+. For more information, please visit countymuseum.ca. Thank you to Sarah Williams for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with an update on U Sports football player Taylor Elgersma.
Thank you, Dinah. History was made in Mobile, Alabama, as Canadian Taylor Elgersma became the first U Sports quarterback to play in the NCAA's Senior Bowl. The 6'5" signal caller turned heads with impressive physical measurables during the week. Of all quarterbacks rated, Elgersma was the tallest, had the largest hands, and had the longest wingspan. These physical attributes and Elgersma's fearless play style led some to compare him to Buffalo Bills superstar quarterback Josh Allen. Elgersma's direct draft comparison, however, is less hyperbolic. Elgersma was compared to an infamous draft bust, quarterback Paxton Lynch. Lynch, a similarly long, lean, and deceptively athletic player, was taken by the Denver Broncos in the first round of the 2016 draft. Though Lynch's career did not pan out, some scouts are more confident that, with the right situation, Elgersma could have a good pro career. Brock Vieira, a writer with Sports Illustrated, noted that Elgersma's best fit would be with the Los Angeles Rams, where he would have time to learn behind their veteran, future Hall of Fame quarterback Matthew Stafford. Elgersma himself slyly acknowledged this connection during his Media Day interviews, noting that he, quote, likes to watch how Stafford operates. Vieira added that he feels Elgersma has 6th or 7th round potential and that he would be, quote, a great project for LA. The Rams would be the ideal situation for Elgersma, but there is no shortage of quarterback-hungry teams in this year's NFL draft. Other teams that may take a flyer on the London-born quarterback include the New Orleans Saints, the Cleveland Browns, and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Elgersma's performance during the Senior Bowl has only added fuel to these draft flames. He connected on a beautiful 43-yard pass in the second half that was equal parts power and finesse. We do not know if Taylor Elgersma will be selected in the NFL draft. No matter what happens in April, however, he has broken new ground for Canadian football and blazed an unlikely trail from U Sports to the apex of professional football.
And thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Now over to LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a report about Greater Napanee Council's decision to not fund the 7th annual GNAAA juried exhibition.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. At their meeting this week, Greater Napanee Council decided against sponsoring the 7th annual juried exhibition and awards show held by the Greater Napanee and Area Arts Association. The town has previously sponsored the event dating back to 2019, with 2022 and 2023 excluded. Last year, Greater Napanee sponsored the event in the amount of $300. Mayor Terry Richardson noted the decision wasn't personal.
It has nothing to do with this organization or this request. There's lots of them out there that will approach us at the town level to get something, because I'm assuming they're thinking that we got lots of money and we can throw it around. I think we can all agree that we probably don't.
The money has always come from the town's public celebrations operating budget, but staff was unsure if there would be enough. Director of Parks, Recreation and Culture, Chris Brown, explained why he brought it to council and noted the council donation budget.
The town of Greater Napanee has sponsored this event before. The decision was made at the staff level, and this is the first time that it's come across my desk, and so I just wanted to bring it to council to get some direction. We do have some additional funds in the council donations budget.
Brown spoke about the difficulty in handling sponsorship requests and noted an extra $2,500 to deal with them this year in the budget.
They come up randomly, right? So it's difficult to budget for because we don't know what sponsorship requests might come in. But we have done that ahead of this year's budget to allow council to be able to support some of these sponsorship requests if they do come in, and given council some wiggle room there to be able to sponsor some of these events that come up.
Staff were ultimately told that no money would be given to the event. Richardson explained sponsoring it through council could lead to issues.
I'll compare it to the requests we get for ice time. We get number of ice time requests to donate ice time so that charity tournaments, all kinds of things like that happen. And we've sort of put an end to that because once you open up the floodgates, it's near impossible to stop it.
CAO Matthew Grant described why the request was brought to council.
Part of the reason to bring this forward, it's one, we recognize the way that it was operating in terms of staff members, entertaining request was not the correct way to do that. And also having some clarity around how council wants to handle these kinds of requests in the future, which are intermittent.
Manager of Executive Services and Municipal Clerk Jessica Walters explained the town's current policy.
Currently, the policy does indicate that the primary vehicle for council grants is those two community partnership funds, but also the policy states that council will hear ad hoc requests throughout the year if they fall outside the budget cycle, if council wants to hear them. So that's an area we could maybe tighten up with more clarity.
Council put forth a new motion to deny the request and made an addition that will see staff revise the town's policy on ad hoc requests so they aren't brought directly to council.
Council does not support or does not approve the sponsorship request as it falls outside the perimeters of the town's community grants policy, and further staff be directed to bring back a revision of the policy that deals with ad hoc requests.
A revision will be brought back to council once complete. The juried exhibition and awards show titled Uncharted Territory will be held at the Museum of Lennox and Addington in March. The Arts Association noted that sponsorships demonstrate a commitment to the value of a thriving arts and culture community and help support programs, workshops, and art exhibitions throughout the area. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Back to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM, Christina Laurie, with an update on the QP labor action at Queen's University.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
I will be honest, it feels bizarre, kind of in limbo. I'm not wearing my work uniform today because I fully believed we were walking out this morning. But yeah, obviously I am I'm happy that this could be resolved at the bargaining table and look forward to seeing the agreement at a ratification vote.
That was Sarah Alux, a caretaker at Queen's University who was involved in getting workers strike ready as negotiations with the university came down to the wire. After extensive discussions right up until late Sunday night, unions representing over 1,000 workers, including caretakers, library technicians, and lab technicians, have reached tentative agreements with Queen's. The university remained, quote, cautiously optimistic in their statements as they continue to update their labor news page throughout negotiations, finally announcing the tentative agreements in a statement on Monday. Workers celebrated their achievements at the bargaining table and the narrow avoidance of a strike at a rally outside of Richardson Hall on Queen's campus. The agreements still need to be ratified by all parties, and full details of the agreements will remain confidential pending their ratifications. However, the mood at the rally was one of hope and relief. Adam Kordick, who is at the bargaining table representing QP254, spoke with CFRC.
It definitely came down to the wire here. I was wondering if you could speak to the challenges and the process leading up to this.
Sure. So being my first time on the bargaining committee, there was a lot to learn, a lot to grasp. Our particular contract is a little bit complicated, but we worked through it and we were able to make some changes that were able to get some funds in the pockets of our members. And we believe we've reached a really good deal. Unfortunately, we're not able to go into details until we fully explain it to our members and get them to ratify it, hopefully this week. But I think we've made a lot of progress. I was really happy with the outcome. I think we made great strides in a lot of non-monetary areas as well, but especially with the deal that finally came across the table. It was a lot of back and forth. It was a lot of restlessness. I've been very, very anxious, but I think all that anxious energy and especially all the preparation we all did. Like, we all got this deal together. We all came together and we got this deal because we were prepared, because we were ready, because we were loud, and I think our voices have been heard, and that's the most gratifying thing.
How are you hoping this can benefit Queens workers?
Firstly, by making sure our members are paid what they're worth, and making sure the members of all the locals here, like, we were all united on this front. I think we came together and we achieved great strides for everybody. And I hope to see this level of coordination and cooperation in the future. And I think I think overall we're going to see a little bit of relief at the end of the month, because I know for many of us that's a very stressful time when the bills are coming in and the money's just not quite there. So I think this will make a huge impact on the lives of our members, and hopefully, like, with our members being in a better state, we're going to be have more positive interactions with the students, and we're going to be able to deliver services at a greater level than we were before.
Are you hopeful that members will be able to ratify this agreement?
Yes, I'm very hopeful. I'm cautiously optimistic was a word that was thrown around a lot last night, and I'm feeling good, and I think that's the most we can ask for at this point.
Other Queens workers also had a strong presence at the rally, showing their support for their QB colleagues. Professor Karen Rudy with the Queens University Faculty Association also spoke with CFRC at the rally.
We recognize as professors that the backbone of the university are many of the QP unions, and we wholeheartedly support them getting better wages and better working conditions.
Final ratification votes will take place in the coming days. This has been Christina Lurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Christina Lurie for that story. Over now to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the positive impact a new warming center has made in Northumberland County.
New statistics provided by Northumberland County appear to show a newly opened homeless shelter in Coburg is already making a positive difference in those that use that service. The shelter transition services on floors 2 and 3 of the facility have been open for approximately 1 month, while the warming room on the ground floor opened 2 months ago. The county states that more than 160 people have accessed either the warming room or shelter services since the doors opened. Approximately 25% of the clients have indicated they were living rough prior to accessing the shelter. 4 couples and 3 people with pets have been among those accessing shelter services, groups that were previously unable to be accommodated. And 7 people have transitioned into permanent housing. County staff presented a data report to the Social Services Committee Tuesday. While the report has limited data due to the shelter only being open a few months, Northumberland County Homelessness Services Manager Bill Smith says data collection will only enhance over time. He adds many of the people accessing the shelter services are coming from a diverse background.
We have people that are coming out of care through children's services, okay, Hospital, jail, treatment, all of those things.
Transition House, which helps operate the shelter, has partnered with Hope and Light Outreach Services and the Salvation Army to provide 2 on-site lunches and 1 dinner meal a week, including meals coordinated by shelter staff more than 450 meals have been provided. Port Hope Mayor Elena Hankifsky says this data and future statistics will be important for service delivery at the shelter.
The other thing that strikes me is as we're collecting this data and we're trying to build cost-driven arguments for the need for more services or different kinds of services or continuity of care, that being able to build up client profiles over time to see who are the greatest users of services or the systems, including the healthcare system, can help to build some of those arguments that are often required when we're advocating for more funding dollars.
Security and safety are a concern for the community. The shelter has installed CCTV cameras to monitor the exterior of the shelter, and security personnel conduct nightly checks of the premises. As well, Coburg police have increased foot patrols in the early morning hours in that area. Alenik Haldeman Township Mayor John Vogel says it appears there is less security issues at the shelter.
The warming center, it has remained relatively stable. I think the average is 27 per night, but it really doesn't go up and down more than three or four from that. And my other comment is more to deal with security. And I expected we'd see some of that. January, we had a rate, and that was lower than we had in November. It is coming down, and you would expect that as people learn more of the rules.
Transition House has been able to coordinate services with six community groups to provide paramedicine, mental health, legal, and addiction services to clients. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, February 13th, it's going to be warmer with a daytime high of -2. Snow flurries from Wednesday night will have ceased by dawn. We're going to see an overnight low of -14, however, with heavy cloud coverage. Friday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, daytime high of -4 with sunny conditions and an overnight low of -10. Saturday, February 15th, daytime high of -3 with a 60% chance of flurries throughout the day and an overnight low of -10. Sunday, February 16th, daytime high of -6 with flurries throughout the day and a warmer overnight low of -3. Monday, February 17th is the coldest day of February thus far with a daytime high of -10 and an overnight low of -19.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.